Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Poet Robert Frost never wanted to be honored only by an elite crowd. He wanted lots of readers to follow him into the yellow wood, into woods lovely, dark, and deep, with snow and horse and farmhouse and miles to go before I sleep. But the celebrated farmer poet, the crusty, woodsy sage of primary school recitals, was in fact a far more complicated and darker man and poet than his public's sentimental reading first suggests. A new collection of Frost's private notebooks, dime store spiral pads stuffed into shirt pockets, gives us a tougher, darker, deeper Frost who's still in love with language. Up next on Point, Dark Frost, from the notebooks of America's great popular poet. We're delighted to have with us today the editor of the hefty new volume, The Notebooks of Robert Frost. Robert Fagan is professor of literature at Claremont McKenna College in California, an eminent Frost scholar. He joins us today from Eugene, Oregon. Bob Fagan, thank you very much for being here.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
And with me in the studio, and we're delighted to have him, is Robert Pinsky, former poet laureate of the United States. He's lectured and written widely on Robert Frost. He's professor of English at Boston University, a great popularizer of American poetry, not least in his book and DVD set, An Invitation to Poetry. Poet laureate, former Robert Pinsky, thanks very much for being here again.
Pleasure to be here, Tom.
Wonderful to have you. Bob Fagan in Eugene, Oregon. Walk us in here. What have we got? What is this great pile of notebooks you've been working on? What are they? How did he use them? Begin to give us a sense of what's in them.
It's really 60 years or more of Frost thinking. Frost thinking fast, Frost thinking hard, Frost thinking all the time. And they're small notebooks, school theme books, the kind of faux marbled theme books or dime store notepads, the kind of things you'd make grocery lists in, but they're not filled with grocery lists. They're filled with meditations on everything from poetics to history, politics, science and philosophy and religion. And Frost's meditations come teeming in one after the other in no particular order. And he obviously kept them with him throughout his life, from the late 1890s on through the early 1960s. Mm. And he would circle back into these notebooks and sometimes revise his thoughts, add to them. And he used them as not as journals in the sense that one would use journals to record personal moments, but to think about things. So they're really Frost, as I said, thinking. Frost thinking about ideas. And he may have also used these books to work on drafts of his poems, but for the most part, they don't have drafts of poems, though he did leave drafts of a number of poems that he didn't publish, so that we have some very interesting drafts, working drafts of poems that he didn't publish in the notebooks.
But whether the drafts or the thinking that informs the drafts, here's, in your word, the laboratory kind of thrown mm-hmm. open to us. Did he ever imagine that people would be sitting around talking about these, you know, on the radio? Were these intended to be private, or did he expect that they would one day be part of a public conversation about himself?
I think he did. Some of the notebooks, a couple of them, he left during his lifetime to libraries. So, for example, one or two of the notebooks that he used for teaching early in his career, he left to libraries, one in particular to the University of Virginia. These are notebooks that he used for teaching early in his career. And several of the notebooks are teaching notebooks that he used at Pinkerton Academy and then later at Amherst College. And they're fascinating because they really reveal Frost the teacher. And he was a provocative and unorthodox teacher and a very committed teacher. And I think one learns a lot about Frost the literary critic and Frost the pedagogue from from these notebooks. And so he did have a sense that they would be left behind. But Frost was also very good at covering his tracks. And I don't think he would have left these notebooks around if he didn't at some point expect that they would be transcribed. On the other hand, the handwriting is for the most part abysmal. Right. And I can't – one doesn't have the sense from them that he cleaned off his desk and spent a lot of time sharpening his pencils or making a point of
Right. No, I've seen the photographs of the pages. These are jotting, scribbling, scratching. Right. This is really a workshop.
I think that he opened these things up and just started writing in them whenever the thoughts came to mm-hmm. him, and some of the most striking thoughts are scribbled in the very corners of, right. of tiny little notepads that are so small that you could fit one in your shirt pocket and still have half a ham sandwich and room for half a ham sandwich. So right. I don't have the sense there of thinking about the ages all the time when he's writing in these things.
You don't have to scratch very deeply with Robert Frost to get behind kind of the school book facade. I mean, Robert Lee Frost, named after his father's greatly admired General Robert E. Lee of the Confederate Army. The fact that he didn't publish his first poems until he was nearly 40, and then not in the United States, but in England. And in these notebooks, this is the two roads diverged paths in the yellow wood guy, but it's not all up and lovely. Life is punishment, he writes in one pretty stark
yes.
entry. Robert Pinsky, as you dip into these decades of Robert Frost notebooks, the lab behind the poems, as a poet yourself, what do you see?
I see a tremendous drama of a mind, of an intellectual. I want to thank Robert Fagan for showing us this mind at work. And this business of, is Frost dark or is he sunny, is he innocent, is he deep? This is part of a much wider and deeper American drama. I think Frost is a symbol of and an enactment of a great American theme, which is our anti-intellectualism on one hand and our aspiration towards culture and education on the other hand. It's in our politics. It's in our culture. It's a great American issue that is crystallized around a great American poet. And Frost understands that. He's in both sides of it. He's deeply, I think, an ally of W.E.B. Du Bois, who's in favor of higher education rather than training. Mm. He's in the line of the Vermont high school dropout, self-taught Senator Morrill, who authored the Morrill Land-Grant Education Act. And he knew both how to play to the crowd that wants to think we don't have to use our brain. And he also, as these notebooks and as the poems demonstrate, he was a deeply questioning, irreverent, deeply learned, though unevenly and unorthodox man of great learning. But he was a very active questioning mind.
Questioning mind and questioning all kinds of precepts. I mean, Bob Fagan, you point out again and again that he was going into deep water here. He set out very deliberately to be a popular poet. He wanted to be read by thousands and said so, but just off stage, he was in waters that would overwhelm most of us on most days.
Well, I think that's true. I think that in some ways he was extraordinarily democratic, but he was democratic the way Jefferson was. That is, Jefferson was an extraordinarily learned man, but he believed in a natural aristocracy. That is, he did not believe he believed in the possibility of people being capable of learning. And he did not believe in being playing a caviar to the crowd as Pound did.
And where did I read somewhere in these entries under the heading of democracy that the line disappointed in the ocean?
Yes, well, that's a phrase that I think is that he writes in relation to some of his later poetry. But I think in some ways what he's hoping for there is even a greater national identity. That is, he wants the ocean to create and this is one interpretation of it, a greater sense of American national identity. That is, he's interested in, and he repeats, this is a phrase he repeats throughout the notebooks, it's a variation, separateness of the parts is almost as important as the connectedness of the parts and things. It's an abstraction. But geographically, I think that he probably felt, and this is, I suppose, an Emersonian thing, that he wanted the nation to be less connected to European ideals and more connected, more of a kind of separate development.
We're going to start to unfold some of the great themes in here. And one is Robert Frost always looking for that aphorism that would catch in the mind. Let's listen as he reads here a portion of Mending Wall. This is recorded in 1951, poem depicting the conflict between two neighbors who have different ideas about the rock wall separating their properties.
Something there is that doesn't love a wall, that sends the frozen groundswell under it and spills the upper boulders in the sun and makes gaps even two can pass abreast. The work of hunters is another thing. I have come after them and made repair where they have left not one stone on a stone, but they would have the rabbit out of hiding to please the yelping dogs. The gaps, I mean, no one has seen them made or heard them made, but at spring mending time we find them there. I let my neighbor know beyond the hill, and on a day we meet to walk the line and set the wall between us once again. We keep the wall between us as we go. To each the boulders that have fallen to each, and some are loaves, and some so nearly balls, we have to use a spell to make them balance. Stay where you are until our backs are turned. We wear our fingers rough with handling them. Oh, just another kind of outdoor game, one on a side, it comes to little more. There where it is, we do not need the wall. He is all pine, and I am apple orchard. My apple trees will never get across and eat the cones under his pines, I tell him. He only says, good fences make good neighbors.
Robert Frost in 1951, reading from Mending Wall. Robert Fagan, of course, this one famously beginning with the idea, something there is that doesn't love a wall, and ending with what seems almost like its opposite, good fences make good neighbors. Two of your themes right there, both his always looking for the pungent aphorism, at the same time is always playing with that kind of contradiction, even within a single poem.
Well, I think it's very important to recognize that there are two sayings in the poem and that the poem begins with one and ends with the other. It's framed by that. And this poem, without getting too involved in this, is a pastoral poem that has a tradition behind it. It's a tradition that goes all the way back to Virgil. And Frost, who wears his learning very lightly, but nevertheless that learning is there, knows his Virgil very well, and he knows this is a kind of eclogue in which the two shepherds often compete in song. And the kind of contrasting sayings are very important. And one of the things that Frost says somewhere in his notebooks is that he just says the fist in your hand. Poetry is neither the hand nor the fist, but the tremor of the deadlock. And that sense of contrast, that sense of conflict, of unresolved conflict, is so much a part of these notebooks and so much a part of Frost's poetry. So very often, we've seen this in contemporary recent politics, people will quote one line from that poem, something, good fences make good neighbors, or people from another political viewpoint will quote another line, something there is that doesn't love a wall, and they will see the narrator of the poem as Frost. And I think that's a dangerous thing to do. Here we have in the notebooks, and it's just one thing in the notebooks, right in the middle of some jottings, some draftings of one of his late poems, we have this. Something there is that doesn't love a wall, something there is that does, and after all, O guileless children, house and pastures, can't you be taught that since the world began, all life upon it has been cellular. Inside and outside cells are all we are. Well, that's a stunning riff or midrash.
Each in our own cell.
Well, no, it's not. You know, all life is cellular, and you know, if you go back farther in the notebooks, he says a great deal about life being cellular, and what that means, because cell walls are permeable, and cells aggregate and they build up units, so that. This is a 19th century a new idea about what the cell means in terms of human life, and Frost is thinking a lot about biology, and he's thinking a lot about what it means for life to be cellular. And you see him in earlier notebooks talking extensively about life being cellular,
singular and permeable at the same time.
That's correct. And so that shows you how contradictory. This is in an earlier notebook, notebook 21. He says, all life is cellular, physically and socially. And then in the next page, he'll say, all life is cellular within the body of a man, and outside his world is the body of society. Our chief disposition of life living is cell walls breaking and cell walls making. Health is a period called peace in the balance of the two. Sickness, a period of war. Health may be too stolid for genius. Now that, you know, that's 200 or 300 pages earlier in the notebooks.
Right. But right there in every line, this love of aphorism or phrases that sound like aphorism, you can hear it bubbling through there, Robert Pinsky.
Yeah, aphorisms that sort of explode themselves. Just to add, I think everything Bob is saying is wonderful about the restlessness of the mind. I think there's a social restlessness in it, too. Bob talked about the narrator of that poem as distinct from Frost. I think a certain number of readers probably assume that Frost grew up in a New England farm. Robert Frost, what was he, Bob, around 10 years old when he had to leave San Francisco, where he was born.
He was born in San Francisco. And
early childhood. Then he lived in a mill town.
That's right.
He lived in Lawrence.
Industrial for its time.
And as with many of us, his imaginative life, his dream life, took place somewhere that was enchanted and infrequent for him, when he would go see part of his family where he did pick berries and he did learn how to milk a cow. Yes. And I think this alternating aphorism and counter-aphorism and tinkering with ideas like Darwinian ideas, biology of the cell, that all is part of a rebellious, restless, dislocated sensibility. And I think there, too, one reason he's our closest as we come to a national poet in many ways is that he is, like a lot of other American ambivalences, the great one being this intellectual one I've mentioned. Is it for learning or is it kind of skeptical of learning? And another one is this feeling at home and homey and small town and farm feeling. Another one, he's an exile. He and his mom hated being in the mill town, hated being dependent on his dead father's father, who was a foreman or some kind in the mill. And I think those social tensions come out in the poems, too, and the notebooks dramatize them.
That line, him savoring, holding up the tremor of the deadlock of the fist in the hand.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Maybe in those kinds of two. He writes later in one of the entries that you cite, Bob Fagan, this even in politics, in the national life, this is such a striking line. He said, and it may be a very American, a nation should be just as full of conflict as it can contain, physically, mentally, financially. But of course, it must contain, the strain must be just short of the bursting point, just short. And this line, the citizen must love his enemy within more than he loves his enemy without. Talk about the tremor in the deadlock. Even his politics, he's promoting
that. I think every one of his poems is partly angry at this person who says the poem. I mean, a poem like Provide, Provide, in a way, it's a skeptical, harsh, saying only thing that really counts is money, another familiar American theme.
Yeah.
And in another way, the poem is a kind of renunciation of that voice and a mocking of the voice.
Do you have a bit of it there, Robert
Pinsky? Absolutely. Provide, provide. The witch that came, the withered hag, to wash the steps with pail and rag, was once the beauty Abishag, the picture pride of Hollywood. Too many fall from great and good for you to doubt the likelihood. Die early and avoid the fate. Or, if predestined to die late, make up your mind to die in state. Make the whole stock exchange your own. If need be, occupy a throne where nobody can call you crone. Some have relied on what they knew, others on being simply true. What worked for them might work for you. No memory of having starred atones for later disregard, or keeps the end from being hard. Better to go down dignified, with boughten friendship at your side, than none at all. Provide.
Hard at the end with boughten so friendship.
Thrillingly and nasty. And I think
and
lines
in
like,
he used
what
to say,
worked for them
my
might
old...
work for you, is really a kind of, it's like a radio slogan for soap. Or patent medicine.
Or cigarettes.
And he's saying what worked for them might work for you. Mm. And there's a touching autobiography. This is related to the notebooks, too. There's something autobiographical in that stanza. No memory of having starred atones for later disregard or keeps the end from being hard. And he made himself a star. He had endured a lot of disregard. Mm. Even when that book finally was published in England, when he was about 40, even
disregard
the favorable
in his years
reviews,
as a school teacher and yeah. out of limelight entirely,
not very good
it.
Farmer, mm-hmm. didn't know enough about farming,
scribbling
to
too
be
much
good
in
at
his notebooks.
Yeah, just a little out of it, and I think not only bitter but sour element in the poem is arguing with himself, and it's a great body of poetry and a great human drama, too. And I'll say again, I'm grateful to Bob Fagan for just bringing that drama out in this new form. I don't think anybody's going to read this book through from page one to the end, but as something to sort of hop around in and mark passages in, it's a wonderful, wonderful book.
I read a review out of London saying, no better book just to open, drop in anywhere into
exactly.
the dime store notebook of Robert Frost. I want to hear from our listeners from Weston, Massachusetts. Nick is on the line. Hi, Nick. You're on the air.
Hi. I had a wonderful experience with Frost, and I think a lot of us did as teenagers because he was a great teacher. And I met him first at my high school at Andover in 1960, and then I saw him alone on the train going to New York later that year, and I sat down with him, sat on the floor. He had a club car seat, so I just sat on the floor with him and happened to have in my pocket by some miracle a poem that me and my family loved, and it was called The Investment. It's about how to cope with the ups and downs of marriage. And it's kind of a Bible for my family about coping with marriage. I love it. I'll read it if you had time, but it really shows...
If it's not too long, Nick, give us a piece at least.
Great. It's over back where they speak of life as staying. You couldn't call it living, for it ain't. There was an old house renewed with paint, and in it a piano loudly playing. Out in the plowed ground in the cold, a digger among the unearthed potatoes, standing still, was counting winter dinners, one a hill, with half an ear to the piano's vigor. All that piano and new paint back there, was it some money suddenly come into, or some extravagance young love had been to, or old love on an impulse not to care, not to sink under being man and wife, but get some color and music out of life?
Great.
It's great.
That's good. Nick, thank you so much for that memory. And was he a sweet guy on the train, in the classroom?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I'd seen him talk to a class earlier, and I thought he was kind of gruff. But with me, one-to-one, he was extremely gentle, empathetic guy. And, I said, you were talking about how he wasn't really a farmer for a lot of his life. I said, how can you apply all this to the city, because we were then rumbling in the train into New York City, and he looked up at these rough buildings outside, rusting slums, and he said, you know, everywhere there's some color and music and life. Look at the plants growing on the balconies of these tenement buildings.
God,
said, you know, it applies everywhere, and it's true. I take that poem with me to this day.
What a great moment. One-on-one there with Robert Frost. Justin in Salem, Massachusetts. You're on the air, Justin.
Hi, Tom. Hi. Great show. I just wanted to call and express just a little surprise maybe at the idea of Frost's darkness being something new. I always found a lot of it in there, and I wondered if I could read a short poem just to illustrate what I'm thinking about.
Our time is short before the break. Go straight to it.
All right. Design. I found a dimpled spider, fat and white, on a white heel all, holding up a moth, like white pieces of rigid satin cloth, assorted characters of death and blight, mixed ready to begin the morning right, like ingredients of a witch's broth, a snowdrop spider, a flower like a froth, and dead wings carried like a paper kite. What had that flower to do with being white, the wayside, blue and innocent heel all? What brought the kindred spider to that height, then steered the white moth thither in the night? What but design of darkness to appall, if design governed in a thing so small?
Justin, let me just say that that illustrates that when we keep repeatedly talking about Frost's darkness as a new discovery, the fact that we keep saying it over and over again as if it were discovery, it says more about us Americans than it does about Robert Frost.
I see.
And you bring it straight to us there in the poem, A Witch's Brew. How great. Justin, thank you very much. There's a wonderful line, Robert Fagan, in a great review of the collection you've put together by Christopher Benfey. He's professor at Mount Holyoke College. And he reminds us of Lionel Trilling saying late in Frost's life, in kind of tribute to Frost, but a mixed one, that he describes Frost being left a little bit speechless, at least in the moment, that I regard Robert Frost as a terrifying poet. What was he pointing to with that, Robert Fagan?
Well, he was, I think, trying to pull the curtain up a little bit on the avuncular image of Frost. And it was a notoriously embarrassing moment because I think Richard Wilbur, who was in the audience at that particular celebration, said, you know, we all knew that Robert was the great poet of hate and fear. So it was something that I think that some people thought was a bit already known or condescending about it. But I think for others, and I think for Frost, you know, it was something that he didn't necessarily want discussed in public. That is, Frost was subtle. And that kind of talk in public wasn't subtle.
I think that was part of Lionel Trilling's argument with American culture. You know, from my slight experience of Washington, I was very surprised to discover that when I would meet people on the Hill, Congress people, senators, almost invariably they seemed much smarter. They knew more things. They seemed more better educated than they ever appeared on TV or the newspaper. And I think that American life and American politics has in it this double thing of a kind of aspiration, you know, the liberal imagination getting larger and democratic culture, vaulting very high. And this other feeling that we only, we're afraid of that and we only trust things that are deprecatory. I love Nick's story about Frost saying, well, you need pianos, you need music and color in the city too. Which is a way of saying that poem about somebody counting how many meals you get out of the land, it is a poem, among other things, the investment, about America. It's about our culture. And do we think only about what we get our meals and material satisfaction out of? Or is there a place as practically as should the kids in the schools have pianos, you know, instead of laptops? And does art have a place in American culture? And I think Frost was very aware of all those things. And the kind of slightly silly excess of Trilling on that occasion is part of a larger argument, part of something else.
Let's go to Carol in Providence, Rhode Island. Carol, you're on the air.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi there. Listen, I just wanted to pass along a story. I don't know if this is an apocryphal tale. I heard this one when I was in college. Apparently some reporters had gone to the home of Frost to let him know of the death of T.S. Eliot, and he sort of growled at them, "Well, that leaves me in Pound." I don't know if
that couldn't have happened because Eliot died after Frost.
Forgive me.
That would be difficult.
Forgive me.
That is so, Carol, that is so characteristic of all good stories.
But there's that. But there is that triangle of Pound and T.S. Eliot and Frost.
It's a very, very complicated relationship, particularly the relationship between Pound and Frost.
Who he met and knew when he was in England, and Pound saying to him, you've got to get out of this old structured verse and into free verse, or you're history, man.
And Frost did not listen to him. And Frost, Pound's alleged influence over Frost was almost nil. Frost, unlike many other people, got published on his own without Pound's help. Mm. And Frost definitely resisted all attempts by Pound to influence him.
But Bob Fagin, it points to one of the great themes of these notebooks, Robert Frost writing again and again about his sort of theory of his own work, the sentence sound, the sort of natural sound of human communication he was always
yes.
looking to fit his verse into. Describe that for us.
Well, it's a recurrent issue in the notebooks, and he talks a great deal about sound and the importance of sound. Sound is the gold and the ore in Frost's poetry, and there are extensive entries in the notebooks about his working out his theories of sound, and there are sometimes mini essays about it.
But he thought that we have a sound in our speech almost like a particular species of bird.
He says in the journals, I'll give a new definition of sentence. A sentence is a sound on which other sounds are strung. And he
That's
gives
correct.
Examples like one, ready, set, go. And you mean to tell me you can't read? And then he says, imagine it from behind a closed door. You can't understand the words. And those are that a sentence is a sound. It is a
kind of archetypal
of pitches.
It is a sound.
Durations.
A sentence is a sound upon which words are strung.
Mm-hmm. And he strung them again and again. But he was kind of the man hearing the structure was his notion, right? Hearing that
he was a great anti-academic. I mean, somewhere in the notebooks he says something about the lack of originality of professors or scholarship and originality. And he says the dead kind of sentence is the kind that's made according to the rules of grammar.
Mm-hmm.
And poetry uses the kind of sentence that is made out of a certain sound. Da-da-da-da-da-da-da. And his writing is more original rhythmically than it seems. I often compare it to William Carlos Williams, that they both really understood that sound of sentences supremely, just beautifully.
There's a bit here from The Oven Bird. This is a poem recorded here in 1961, Robert Frost, discussing the nature of the bird and its song, and through its use of sentence sounds, kind of primal patterns of verbal tone, you can hear Robert Frost evoking the sounds of nature here.
There is a singer everyone has heard, loud, a midsummer and a midwood bird that makes the solid tree trunks sound again. He says that leaves are old and that for flowers midsummer is to spring is 1 to 10. He says the early petal fall is past when pear and cherry bloom went down in showers on sunny days a moment overcast. And comes that other fall we name the fall. He says the highway dust is over all. The bird would cease and be as other birds, but that he knows in singing not to sing. The question that he frames in all but words is what to make of a diminished thing.
Robert Frost reading his The Oven Bird in 1961. You hear the rhythm there. Tor is calling from Northampton, Massachusetts. Hi, Tor, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks. I'm calling to get your guest to comment maybe on Frost's take on religion. Two poems I have in mind. One is the design poem that somebody read earlier implies that he sort of believes there is a design in the universe that's in a sort of religious way. And there's another poem, I forget the exact wording of it, but it's something about some thought the omnibus had no purpose until it got to us. And he was sort of arguing against those who feel that there's no meaning in life. And so that implied to me that maybe Frost has some religion at the back of everything, and I wondered if your guest could comment on that.
Bob Fagin, please.
Yeah, this is a very difficult and very complex subject. I think the notebooks are helpful in some way insofar as there's an enormous amount of material in the notebooks about this, but it will only lead you into more discussion, more complexity. Frost said a number of things about religion, and there are writings about Christianity, about the Bible in the notebooks. I don't think that anything is conclusive.
Bob, I was knocked out by a passage. I was just amazed by a passage where he says, we Puritans, this and that. He says, maybe we Puritans would have been better off if we'd stayed in the church that we went away from. He says, we should have stayed Catholics. My old teacher, Ivor Winters, wrote an essay about Frost called The Spiritual Drifter as Poet. And it's a negative way of putting something I think is true. Frost was Emersonian. He was a part of that New England tradition where the old Calvinist beliefs have fallen away. He's not really a Puritan anymore. But all of the ethical habits, all of the sort of Emersonian questing is still there. So I guess he's a kind of a vague Emersonian theist. But he certainly is much more agnostic than Christian. You can't get around that.
Bob Fagan, you cite this phrase, knowledge, from Francis Bacon here, which I found such a great phrase from Bacon, having regard to God, no perfect knowledge, but wonder, which is broken knowledge, and Frost picking up on that.
Yes, but that describes him working in a kind of ruins of knowledge. It almost reminds me of the shards that one finds, the shattered knowledge that one could find both in Bacon, or I suppose even in certain ideas of the Kabbalah. But I want to be very careful here. In some ways, Frost was rather concerned with problems of theodicy. If you look at his late masks, which are based on the Book of Job and Jonah,
Mask of Reason,
Mask of Reason and Mask of Mercy, I think you see him working through problems of theodicy. And it's interesting that he chooses two books of the Hebrew Bible to base those on. And there are two books that, for example, were of great concern to Melville. So I think there's a dialogue that's going on there about theodicy that takes him back through Melville, takes him back through Milton. And even though there's a kind of lightness on the surface, I think that when we look at Frost, we have to look back through Job and the kind of dramatic tensions that are going on in the Book of Job. Yeah. And he had a dialogue in the 1940s with Rabbi Victor Reichert, who was he met in Cincinnati, was his neighbor in Vermont, and that dialogue was very intense. In the Mask of Mercy, it's interesting. One figure, and it's just one figure. Yeah. That's something you have to be very careful about. Keeper says, "I'd rather be lost in the woods than found in a church," and there's something very striking about that that resonates in Frost, but. I think that, I'm hesitant. I'd be hesitant. I'd kind of disagree a little bit with Robert about Frost being Emersonian. I think that the tendency for Frost is a little bit more intense to ask certain probing questions about theodicy that Emerson abandoned.
But maybe church, still a little too much to hope for in that Mask of Reason. You quote him, he puts in Job's wife's mouth this phrase that all we have perhaps is lots of unsystematic stray scraps of palliative reason. Talk about
yes.
Broken knowledge. I want to go to Columbia, South Carolina, and Jane. Hi, Jane, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I have a question for Professor Pinsky. I had an opportunity at UVA to look at some of the notebooks myself, and I just have a hard time with the concept that the rating is abysmal, and when I compare my notes to Professor Fagan's, I just notice there are lots of omissions and what I would think are mistranslations. And so my question is, how do we accept, when we have this radical reinterpretation of Frost, how do we accept that this is the right one? I mean, are there other books we could compare it to? I'll take my answer off the air.
Robert Pinsky, Bob Fagan?
Well, there's only one notebook at the University of Virginia and a couple of sheets. And the Virginia notebook, as far as I know, yielded pretty much a transcription with almost no variance, and it was compared against several other transcriptions. So I'm not quite sure what you're referring to.
In principle, Jane raises an interesting matter. I actually trust Bob Fagan's scholarship very, very much, completely. The question of how we see things, she used the word translation, which I guess there's some other term, transliteration. It's a legitimate question, but we perceive everything through a whole series of screens of editings, and somebody says that every poem is a translation. I'm grateful to have a vision of this, and I don't think this is a radical. Anybody who's devoted to Frost really reads him. There's no radical new idea of who Frost is or what his writing is here. It's a rich trove of new things. I was very moved to read that poem, something like Old Gold for Christmas.
Yes.
Which is a kind of dialogue between an old guy who's fallen down in the ice and the poet. And it is an urban setting. And it has all kinds of social and political and philosophical resonances. And that it was an unfinished poem was part of why it was so moving to me. Mm-hmm. And I would probably tend to guess, Jane, that Bob Fagan didn't get one syllable wrong in transcribing it. But even if he got four wrong, I'm still very glad to have that fragment. Mm.
Old Gold for Christmas, and right there you hear that. I mean, the phrase that will draw in anyone on the surface, and then you can go anywhere with it. You quote a poem near the end of your notes, Bob Fagan, Pertinax, let chaos storm, let cloud shapes swarm, I wait for form. Maybe the ultimate Robert Frost message there, but just pulling form, looking for form, giving us that moment's rest from confusion.
Well, there's an interesting thing there. That little poem, the title of that is a Latin word that means stubborn, and we often take that as the Frostian message that he is going to be stubborn or wait for form against chaos. Mm. But in the notebooks, there is a much longer poem being developed called Pertinax, which is actually about a Roman emperor who only lasted a few weeks. So the notebooks reveal something about that poem that is, in a way, in complete contrast to the poem he published.
Chaos at the top, form at the bottom, Robert Frost all the way in between. Robert Fagan, the new book is The Notebooks of Robert Frost, and it's big and deep and wonderful. We're grateful to you for all your work with it, and thank you for joining us today.
Thank you for having me. Thank you very much, Tom.
And Robert Pinsky, former poet laureate of the United States, now at Boston University. Wonderful to have you with us.
This was a lot of fun.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Mm-hmm.